Thanks, Roger, for hosting me and for having me at this program. I realized only when I came here how diverse actually the group of people is that are attending this program. So I will follow in Fiala's lead in discussing what we are interested in when we do machine learning for the many fermion problem and condensed matter wedge type problems. So the first thing that I should do is acknowledge my collaborators. I was dragged into this machine learning business by my graduate student, Peter Brucker, who graduated last year. We worked early on with Roger and Juan, later with Fakhar Saad on many fermions, and then with Yuna, Frank, and my grad student, Carsten Bauer, on transport problems. So in condensed matter, we are interested in quantum matter. Yeah, so interesting states of matter, yeah, like superconductors or Bose-Einstein condensates, which are intrinsically quantum many-body states, and we would like to discuss them and phase solutions like the one between water and ice between them, and get a handle on these collective quantum many-body states. Yeah. So these are well-known examples. So the first question our field always is, when do you find something new, and when does something interesting come up? And here's a general theme for when do interesting things happen. And that is, what you want to take is a system of many quantum mechanical degrees of freedom. So these can be bosons, if you want to do a Bose-Einstein condensate. These can be fermions, if you want to form a superconductor. Or these can be spins, if you have some quantum magnet that you're interested in. They're interacting. So they're interacting with one another, and you cannot treat them in a mean field type of way, but you have to really consider the many-body problem. And interesting stuff happens if the interactions between these many degrees of freedom somewhat conspire to give you a scenario where there's many degenerate energies. So where the interactions of order one do not result which of the states in your system is a true ground state, but instead there's a huge degeneracy of many different states that have all energies close to one another, and the ground state is somewhere in this degenerate manifold. And this degeneracy should be accidental, in the sense that there is no symmetry that protects this degeneracy, but it's just by energetics that this happens. So what then can happen is that in a residual effect, something small can lift that degeneracy, split these states, and select a ground state. Yeah, and that ground state is then the interesting state of matter that we're interested in. Yeah, so here's one example of the famous example of this paradigm, and that's a phase diagram of cuprate superconductors. But you see, in a phase diagram of temperature versus hole doping, are many different phases. And that's, at this stage, all we're supposed to appreciate. There's five different phases in this phase diagram that you can, tune to by varying parameters. And you end up in these different states by doing, very little to your system. And why is that? Well, there's one belief, and that is, here, underneath that superconducting dome, there hides a quantum critical point. A quantum critical point where, you have a phase transition between two quantum phases. We will discuss this in more detail later in this talk. And at that point, many things, there's many different gapless modes, and detuning the system, with these external parameters in one way or the other, you end up in these different phases. Yeah. So the quantum critical point is the one that gives you the degeneracy, and then this residual effect is tuning these parameters. Another standard example of this idea is a fraction quantum Hall effect, where Landau levels are partially filled, giving you a huge degeneracy, and then interactions between the electrons give you that topological state of matter. And probably the latest entry in this scheme is twisted bilayer graphene, which many of us are discussing at the moment, where the twisting of the graphene sheets leads to exactly a flat band, which is again a degeneracy. It's accidental in the sense that just by fine-tuning the angle, this flat band emerges. And then, interaction effects drive the system in all kinds of different phases, correlated insulators, superconductors, anomalous Hall effects, all are closed by in that system. So this is an interesting scheme that repeats itself in condensed matter, and that's very hard to deal with. So why is it so? Well, because, you know, intrinsically you have different, you know, multiple energy skips, you know. So what gives rise to that accidental degeneracy is, you know, the interactions of order one are much bigger than the residual effect, you know, the small interaction that eventually lifts this and, you know, gives rise to, you know, the topological state, the superconducting state, you know, that interesting graphene state, you know. So we have to deal with these multiple energy scales. You know, sometimes you have complex energy landscapes on top of that. So, you know, moving around in these energy scales isn't that easy. Quantum state can form macroscopic entanglement. You know, entanglement occurs on many degrees of freedom, and the system becomes topological that way. And we're always in strong coupling, so we cannot do mean field theory. So to attack this problem, quantum many-body simulations have been developing all kinds of techniques over the last, you know, 2 to 3 decades to solve this problem. Yeah? You know, the answer to the question, you know, what is the ground state of that, you know, macroscopic ensemble of interacting degrees of freedom in such a situation where these interactions are not easy to solve. Yeah? And the stream of, you know, computational advances that has been shown at this problem, yeah, you know, probably starts in the mid-90s with the advent of quantum Monte Carlo with non-local updates and the concurrent development of the identity matrix normalization group. Yeah? So, you know, that allowed us to, you know, for instance, study quantum phase transitions in bosonic systems using Monte Carlo, you know, to discuss entanglement in one-dimensional systems. You know, that actually entanglement is a key resource to discuss and use in numerical methods, as then, you know, become, you know, extremely clear, you know, some 10, 15 years later, early 2000s, you know, when this entanglement perspective, you know, area laws in quantum many-body systems and tensor network states have been discussed. And somehow I see machine learning as, you know, the next step in this evolution now. You know? So, you know, we have been constantly developing more and more refined algorithms. And I think what we are doing in this program is just, you know, the next step in that sequence of things. Yeah? And why is that, you know, the right thing to do? Well, as you all know, in this machine learning program, you know, the principal advantages of machine learning are dimensional reduction and feature extraction. They are like the perfect match to the problem that, you know, that we are trying to solve. Yeah? So if you discuss, you know, the wave function of the quantum many-body system, you know, that it has a exponential complexity, and you would like to understand, you know, which features in that wave function are actually the interesting and dominant ones, you know, that describe that state of matter. You know? So, you know, all the talks about state tomography, Bolzmann machines, you know, they go along this way. The second avenue is the second thing, you know, that is, you know, you can simulate quantum states in Monte Carlo, and you get an abundance of, you know, correlation functions that you might potentially look at. You know? So 2-point, 3-point, 4-point correlation, all kinds of things. You know? And you might not know, you know, which ones are the ones, you know, that you're supposed to look at to find out, you know, that you have an interesting, you know, quantum state at hand, you know, in your computer. So how do you solve, you know, that problem? You know? So, you know, my talk will be concerned with the second question, and how we can, you know, make use of the data, you know, that other, you know, numerical techniques, you know, throw at us, and that we might want, you know, look at in some new way. As we know in this program, you know, machine learning comes in all kinds of flavors, different learning themes, and different types of artificial neural networks that are underlying, you know, these approaches, Let me say that I will be, you know, living in this upper corner, so I will talk about supervised learning and unsupervised learning, and I will, you know, mostly use convolutional neural networks, you know, to do so. Yeah? So here's today's menu. Yeah? So we want to ask, you know, this question: how can we identify quantum phases of matter, quantum states of matter, you know, using machine learning tools? You know? And what we will be working with will be convolutional neural networks that you know, add, you know, to the conventional artificial neural network, you know, several pre-processing steps, and the most important one for us is going to be the convolution, you know, that gives the name to this approach, in addition to, you know, pooling and additional convolution steps. Yeah, good. So this will be a network architecture that we will be using again and again in this talk. So let me start explaining what the convolution is for those of us you know, that are not coming from, you know, the field of machine learning, have been working with this for ages. So the standard example often is, you know, digit recognition. And if you look at, you know, the simplest examples of, you know, bit encoded digits, you know, you can see, oh, you know, a one in this picture here, and actually has very little information in it in the terms of recurring themes. There's a top and a bottom end to this one, and then there's a straight line in between. And then if you look at the two, it's also, you know, made up of relatively simple sub segments, you know, that you can, you know, identify to characterize these digits. Yeah. So a convolution now is to use, you know, the information in the pixelated image and a filter, and then convolute the two with one another. Yeah. So you do a piecewise multiplication of the entries in these two matrices, sum that up, that gives you a new entry. That's a convolution. Yeah. So let's see how we can take, you know, such a filter here, yeah, and convolute it. Not, you know, this is an image of the same size, but with a bigger one, by sliding it, you know, over it. So here's our original picture. You know, here we now slide that filter over it, and then for every, you know, location we do that convolution. That gives us an output, and you know, thereby we generate out of the original image, yeah, a new convoluted one. Yeah. Good. So why is that of any benefit? Well, first of all, you know, the filter that is being moved across, you know, this image, yeah, does something for us. It encodes, you know, locality. Yeah? It's a 3x3 matrix in this sense. Yeah, so it will start to, you know, accumulate knowledge about, you know, these 3x3 points in a new point in that image here on the right. Yeah, and so on. Yeah, so that, you know, that is actually very important, because, you know, oftentimes we do have images that have, you know, x and y coordinates have some meaning to them. They are in these matrices, and you know, pixels in the upper left corner are correlated on the lower right corner. And, you know, they shouldn't be fed into, for instance, a neural network without that locality information. In addition, you know, the filter that we are sliding across the original image here is something that we train and learn in the training step of the neural network as well. So we do not say, you know, what that filter is explicitly, but we, you know, we find out along, you know, in the optimization of the neural network what the best filter to do this convolution actually is. You know? Good. So so let's try.
In your example, the filter made the two look a little messy.
Yeah.
Is the filter ideally supposed to make it sharper?
But, you know, so this, you know, you see that, you know, here it's a perfect match, and that's, you know, where you get that highlighted point. Yeah. And so what you can see from that is, you know, that you see that this particular shape, yeah, is in there, yeah, but it's in only once. Yeah. If I would have taken that straight line over the one, you know, you would have a lot of hits, yeah? So it would have been a much bigger signal, yeah? So here, you know, indeed, you know, it looks like an original tool, and all you learn is that you get, you know, one real good hit, yeah? Good. So now let's try to, you know, use this idea and apply this now in the context of a condensed matter type problem, yeah? So let's assume the following. I have some system, some Hamiltonian, that describes a system of many interacting degrees of freedom. And then now that as I tune some parameter in that Hamiltonian, I will go from one phase, you know, to some other phase. You know? So I have phase A and phase B, and somewhere in between there's a phase transition. You know? Probably I don't know where that phase transition is. You know? Can I find out? You know? So can I, you know, tune this parameter and classify, you know, everything below the phase transition as being part of phase A, and everything above it is part of phase B. So how could I do that? Well, I can try to use a supervised learning approach, where I say, well, you know, I have this a priori knowledge that I know that, you know, deep in, you know, some parameter regimes, you know, for instance, if there is temperature, at low temperatures and high temperatures, I do know, you know, what the phases of my system are, and I can, you know, generate instances of that phase and train that, you know, and use it as training data for a neural network. Yeah? So I generate these representative images of the phase, train the convolutional network here, say, you know, this is phase A, train it here and say, this is phase B. And then I use the so-trained network and expose it to data that is generated from, you know, parameters in between these two extremal training points, and ask the network to classify again the data as being either of part of phase A or phase B. So let's do that by example, and let's do the example that Roger and Juan have been doing, working on 2 years ago. You know, so the first question that you have to ask is, you know, what are the right images, you know, to feed into this? And the simplest example that you can do is, you know, statistical really is always the Ising model. So you have, you know, classical Z2 spins that can either point up or down. And, you know, they have some interaction, you know, that wants to align them so that at low temperature, you know, they form, you know, large magnetic domains. So you're in a ferromagnet at high temperature, you know, where your temperature scale is much bigger than interaction strength, you know, that doesn't matter, and the spins are just random. And there is a phase transition in between, you know, at a critical temperature. And we know everything about, you know, this type of phase transition from, you know, solving that Ising model many, many years ago. Yeah? So we can now apply this idea, you know, and say, well, you know, let's take some low temperature, you know, some high temperature, you know, sample, you know, the Ising model, for instance, using Monte Carlo, which means, you know, we are generating a Markov chain of configurations. We use exactly those configurations that, you know, in the Markov chain are generated, and feed that as images, as training data into a neural network, you know, trained here and here on the low temperature and the high temperature phase, and then, you know, we expose images like this one to the trained network, and then we see, you know, this sigmoidal function going from 0 to 1, indicating that here you're in the one phase, here you're in the other phase, and vice versa for the other phase. And you can even see that, you know, as you increase system size, you know, you see a nice finite size behavior of that transition sharpening up exactly at the known phase transition of, you know, the Ising model. Good. So that worked. Yeah. So one natural question is, if that works for the Ising model, which is like this paradigmatic, you know, classical subsurface model, can we, you know, carry this over to the quantum world, and, you know, can we do this with, you know, quantum phases of matter?
So were those the system sizes on the side that by 10?
Yeah, so this is 10 by 10 up to 60 by 60. And, you know, the color code, you know, this sort of becomes darker. So you see that, you know, you go to these lines, you know, that have a more sudden transition. And actually, Juan and Roger showed that you can actually collapse, you know, these curves onto what top of one another. And in principle, extract the coding exponent here. You know? Now, we can do this, you know, to much better precision, you know, using other schemes. You know, we don't have to rely on this idea. You know? So the order parameter of the Ising model, the magnetization, you know, it's much, much better, you know, to do that. And that's also, you know, exactly what you need to do.
Pink versus blue lines.
What's that? Oh, the pink versus blue. So that's, so the blue is, you know, you're training on the low temperature phase. The red is your training on the high temperature phase. You know, so the blue line says, you know, you're in the low temperature phase, so you're no longer, you know, and they're coupled, so they add up to one. Okay. Yeah, and the point of maximal confusion here at 1/2, yeah, so where the neural network cannot decide, you know, whether you're in phase A or phase B, that's exactly the point, you know, where the phase transition occurs. Okay, so now we want to carry that idea over to the quantum world, and so we pick some simple quantum model, and you know, one of the simplest quantum models that you can look at is the Hubbert model, which is a competition between kinetic and potential energy for quantum mechanical degrees of freedom. So we like this model, yeah. So we, you know, put ourselves on a honeycomb lattice. We take spinful fermions, you know, that are hopping on this lattice, and they feed an interaction between them. And you can drive a phase transition, a fermionic phase transition, a Gauss-Navier phase transition between a semi-metal to a spin-magnetic ordered phase. Yeah. So this semi-metal, that's the one, you know, that has a Dirac cone here, yeah. And then, you know, you end up in a correlated state over here. Okay, good. So you could say, you know, let's try exactly the same protocol. Yeah, we select, you know, 2 points, you know, deep in these phases, and we use those, you know, to train our neural network, and then we try to predict, you know, what's happening in between, and let's ask, you know, whether we can find, you know, this phase transition here. You know? But if you're working with a quantum state, you have to first address the question of, you know, what is actually the image, you know, that you're supposed to look at. Yeah, so the stuff that you want to feed into your convolutional neural network. Yeah, so for that, it's we make a slight detour of how we actually simulate these things, you know, in a computer. When we again, you know, apply, for instance, a quantum Monte Carlo technique. Quantum Monte Carlo is working in the integral representation of the partition sum. Yeah, so we are looking at trace of e to the minus beta h, and you know, you have to sample that partition sum For fermions, what we typically do is that we do a Hubbard-Zdanovich decoupling, which gives us, at the end of the procedure, free fermions in a classical background field. And so there's, this classical background field is, for instance, one, that one could, think of, using as an input for the neural network, or a property that is actually not dependent on the precise form of your Hubbard-Zdanovich decoupling, because you can do this in different channels, is a Green's function. So let's work actually with that object. So the Green's function talks about this correlator. You take a particle from side I and you move it over to side J, and you can do this for arbitrary pairs of sides I and J, giving you a matrix for this Green's function that you can calculate Monte Carlo estimates off in the sampling process of the quantum Monte Carlo.
So the Green's function doesn't depend on spin to keep the
loop. What's that?
Green's function doesn't depend on spin to keep the
loop. So the you can add that, yeah. So you can add a spin to that, yeah. So what, yeah. So more importantly, the Green's function is a complex valued object, yeah. So where we had real images before, we now have complex objects, which for the neural network is not a problem whatsoever, yeah, because of a real imaginary part that we just have two layers, in your input. We need something to color code that so that you can look at this. We're using this HSV scheme to look at the phase and amplitude of the complex number to provide you these images. So as I said, in that Hubbard model on the honeycomb lattice, you go from a semi-metal, that Dirac cone phase, yeah, to a spin density wave phase, yeah. So these are the two phases, and if you're not red-green blind, you see some difference, between these images of the Green's functions, yeah. But it's subtle, yeah. To say, what are the distinguishing features now between, the upper four and the lower four, beyond that color, color encodes the amplitude. Good. So now we are doing it.
On that figure also, each pixel is a single side.
So each pixel, now is the information about the Green's function for one pair. Yeah. Okay. So So it says, so I'm, So it's Gij. So I take a particle from here and I put it there. Yeah. So this is, I take a particle from side one and put it at one. Yeah. So the important information is that this Green's function, that this matrix, has locality encoded in it. Yeah. So actually, the what is a row here and what is a column here is important. Yeah. So you cannot shuffle them around. Now, for instance, you see something. There's a feature here on the diagonal. Yeah. And that's a real feature. Yeah. And that's important for us. That we have this information. What is a row and what is a column has a meaning. Yeah. If two columns are close by or not. Yeah. Because that is what we will be using when we do these convolutions. Yeah. These convolutions are only supposed to give you any benefit. If encoding locality actually helps you. So that should be contrasted with other matrices that we might be looking at. Yeah? So use some other approach, the density matrix synchronization. You have the density matrix. Or you say, let me convolute the density matrix. Well, that isn't giving you much benefit because a row and a column in a density matrix is just reflecting how you enumerate a basis. Yeah, and that's totally arbitrary. Yeah? So so correlating columns doesn't help you. It's not supposed to help you.
Were you before me?
I had a question.
Oh. Well, then I was wondering that the answer to the question of why do we want to use images at all to encode quantum state as images is because we can use convolutional neural networks, or is there?
So what has been driving us is, it's the fact that we have seen that these image recognition algorithms work extremely well. Yeah. So convolutional neural networks. Yeah. So as an outsider to the field of machine learning, that's something that you clearly saw, that all of a sudden, image recognition has gone through the roof. So that was, what drove us, to ask this question, if there's a, set of powerful algorithms, can we apply them to our problem? Yeah. Of course, conventional image recognition, which is done in your iPhone or surface computer to unlock, a screen, is face recognition. Yeah. And it's done for a problem that's very different from trying to discriminate these things, so Green's functions. So that was our impetus, trying to see how those algorithms that work so well in that field and how they carry over here. In addition to the fact, you know, that as numerical practitioners, you know, we are dealing with these images all the time. You know, so we have them at our hand. Yeah, so you know, tons of data. Yeah, and in this, you know, what I'm talking about, you know, we are literally looking at tens of terabytes of data at the end, you know, that we can store and, you know, scramble through and look at.
So these maps were not specifically designed for your problem, or is something that they usually?
No, so these, yeah, so these are, you know, this equal time single particle Green's function is a very standard object, yeah, in quantum statistical physics, yeah. So it's, yeah, so we get, you know, we looked at it and said, well, you know, that's a, you know, that's a pixelated matrix, you know, can we use that as an input? And it does represent the quantum state. And even more so, the ensemble of these Green's functions, you know, so that you get along the Markov chain. Good. Okay. So we have, you know, we have looked at this now. Yeah. We see a slight difference.
But one might have thought with the SDW that you'd say, well, rather than the single particle guide, I go after a spin susceptibility,
yeah,
which I could also measure. It's a two-particle Green's,
yes,
function.
Yes. That's.
And mm-hmm. Knowing that, you might say, oh, that'll make it much more visible.
Yes, so that's now a specific trade-off that you have to make. So you can go to your specific problem and say, you know, I have some physics intuition, and I know so many things, and I already actually know what, you know, these two phases are, and I know what their order parameters are, or, you know, how they reveal themselves in certain correlation functions, and I can use those exactly to train stuff. But then I'm just repeating myself. Yeah. So what I really try to do is, you know, come up with a scheme that is, you know, somewhat general. Yeah. So that, you know, for the unknown, you know, I have a chance of, you know, trying to dig through my data and, yeah. So in the Ising model, you know, of course you could have just looked at a single spin and, you know, look at the magnetization, and that would have helped you already. And that's, you know, that's actually what they did, Roger and Holland. Good. So now this is our data, yeah, you know, this Green's function. And now this is really what we do, yeah. So now we do the convolution. Now on the Green's function, you know, feed that information, you know, the convoluted image, into yet another convolution. You know, we pool. That means, you know, we make, you know, the image smaller in between by, you know, compressing pixels, and then we feed that thing at the very end in a conventional artificial neural network that you know, two outputs, you know, phase A and phase B. You know? Good. And so here's the output. You know? So the parameter that we are now varying is the interaction strength. You know? So we go from the weakly correlated to the correlated state by increasing this interaction. We take 2 points. You know, these are the ones that are marked red here, you know, which are below and above, you know, the phase transition respectively, and use those to train the neural network. And then we take points, you know, deep in the phase, you know, across the transition, and, you know, deep in the other phase, and classify, you know, the Green's function images that we get, you know, using these convolutional neural networks. And what you find is, you know, a picture that looks very much like what we have seen before. You know, you transition from 1 to 0 or 0 to 1, you know, from one phase to the other phase, and with increasing system sizes, yeah, you see that you get a curve that sharpens up. Yeah. And now for your benefit, there is, you know, two vertical lines here. So the solid one, it's a phase transition line that people, you know, Fakhar Asad and colleagues have determined for the exact same finite size data, you know, using system sizes from 6 to 15, you know, coming up where the phase transition is, so that's here. Yeah, and the dashed line is, you know, Sandel Savella using much larger system sizes, you know, in doing a refined finite size scanning, and finding the transition is here. And we find that our machine learning approach, which does nothing fancy, you know, finds the transition just, you know, right smack in the middle between these two bounds. Yeah.
Is it possible that the convolution of Green's function is actually, if you could look in the neural network and ask, how does it know that what it's done by convoluting,
yeah,
these,
so that,
is
so that's
susceptibility?
Yeah, so that's a question about, you know, interpretability of, you know, what the neural network actually does. And that's generally very difficult. Yeah. So that comes back to the question that Mike asked at the beginning. You know, so what is actually that you learn from these filters? And even for, you know, a simple to relate to picture, like, you know, a phase or whatever, if you look what these convolutional filters actually are, you cannot make any sense out of them. Yeah. So, and it doesn't help here neither. Yeah. So if you look at these filters, yeah, you know, that's nothing that gives you physical insight or any insight, you know, at least to me. I don't know whether the machine learning people in the audience agree more on that.
How they're convoluted? what's the actual algorithm for convolution?
So that's what's happening here. Yeah. So you have this convolutional filter, yeah, which you swipe across the image, yeah, and that you train, you know, with the data initially. So initially, you know, we put ourselves, you know, to these two parameter points. Yeah. We generate, you know, using the Monte Carlo, you know, tons of these Greens function images. Yeah. And now we have this, you know, this setup of a neural network, which includes the convolution, but we don't say what the filter is. We optimize, you know, the entries in the filters, you know, on the training data. Yeah? And that the training worked extremely well. You can see by the fact, you know, that, you know, everything here is you know, solidly zero, and everything here is solidly one. Yeah? So we were able to discriminate, you know, those two faces.
I'm just trying to guess, but like if you were trying to recognize the face, would you like one of the filters would be an eye?
That's what the folklore is, yeah. But it's not, you know. So that's what you would think, you know.
Yeah. I'm wondering.
But it's not, yeah. So if you look at these filters for image recognition, what you see is like, you know, weird things, you know, that you cannot relate to in a way that you say, oh, you know, this is the eyes, this is the nose. Yeah.
But just kind of following up on Doug's question, do you think it's possible, on the one hand, that it really is measuring something we would recognize, like the stability, but it's just like scrambled up due to the overparameterization and like kind of a gauge transformation going on inside there? Or do you really have a feeling that it's doing something really beyond what we would come up with?
Maybe
it's hard to answer. But
yeah, that's hard to answer. Yeah. So we couldn't make any sense out of these. You know. So probably, you know, those people that are coming with the machine learning background, you know, they can say whether for some other problem, you know, the convolutional filters themselves, you know, have been particularly insightful in guiding, you know, towards understanding of, you know, what that entire process does.
So if you try the same thing with the feed-forward neural net without the convolutions, how does it compare?
Yeah. So if you do that, yeah, you know, then you quickly realize that these images are really big. Yeah. So you're no longer using 28 by 28 pixels, you know, in the digit recognition, but now, you know, you have a couple of hundreds matrices here, yeah, and then, you know, not doing the convolution, you know, what you end up with, you know, a lot of spread out data that is unorganized, yeah, so it does much more poorly, yeah, than you know, with having the convolution in it, yeah? So training with the convolution is much easier.
And how do you like choose the architecture? For instance, how does the picture depend on the number of layers on the hyperparameter tuning?
Yeah, so that's that's a question that's very good. You know, so we do this completely heuristically. Yeah, so we know that we want to be able to discriminate at some point. Yeah, so we fiddle with those parameters until we manage to do that. Yeah, so that's not very systematic.
Right, maybe there are like two ways to fiddle the parameters that we both discriminate.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I'm very much aware of that pitfall. Yeah. So you know, the entire setup here, you know, you can ask, you know, all these questions. You know, why is this 512 neurons and not 256? You know, why do you do two times, you know, the convolution, not three times? You know, why you fiddle 3x3 and not 5x5? Yeah. And I don't have a good answer to that. You know, but you know, saying that heuristically, you know, we find that this works for us.
No, I understand, but what I'm asking is if you say find two different heuristic ways how to set the parameters with which you get a really good training error, do you have any insight to say that the picture you are showing us will look the same? Couldn't the crossing be somewhere else?
So no, I don't. And actually, that's what I'm hoping for, you know, to learn from the machine learning community and not the other way around. Yeah, so, you know, so. Yeah, you know, what we are doing is, you know, apply these techniques in that sense, and you know, we are trying to make them work. It was very easy to make them work, yeah, in that sense. Yeah, but you know, why these algorithms work, you know, that's something that should come out of the machine learning community, as it's the hardcore machine learning community.
I mean, it's still a little different question, in the sense that, you know, not maybe today, but if the machine learning people can answer something, they will be able to answer. Why can you train and generalize well on the training data? But here you are then testing it on a data that are inside the interval. You're trying to extrapolate.
Exactly. So
and I think there is very like little in that direction.
Exactly. So that's a deviation from what, you know, the typical examples are, which are much more discrete. You know? So you distinguish, you know, apples from pears or dogs from cats, these kind of things. So these are discrete things. Yeah, while I, you know, vary continuously some parameter, and I want, you know, to basically be sensitive only to the biggest change here. Yeah, and that's certainly a weakness, and we will resolve that weakness, you know, in a couple of slides. You know, the fact that we train on, you know, two far away data points, you know, And you know, physically we know that things do change, yeah, as we vary the parameter. Yeah, but there's only one big change, and that's here. Yeah, that's the phase transition, and we want to find that.
Right. So, just I came in late, obviously. Do you always train on one U, or can you train on things at different U's to get like a broader sample of what the phase
so
looks like?
Of course.
Yeah. I guess.
So you can do that, and you can do exactly this to, you know, for instance, go closer to the phase transition and refine this, and then get an ensemble of these things. So when it's in the Ising model, we immediately understand if you were to go to the lowest temperature, that's a way too extreme example. Yeah, everything is polarized. So if you go to some finite temperature, you immediately have something that looks different. So you start having small nucleations of disordered phases. So this is already different. Yeah. So that's not good. Yeah. Because you know, you could say these are two different phases, but you don't want that to be two different phases. Yeah. So you want to trigger only on the phase transition. So which really means that you want to do something infinitesimal. Yeah? So let's come to that in just a second.
Sorry, another question. Have you tried them like on other like data sets, like representing the same quantum states, like you mentioned, possible like the field possibility?
Yeah. So we did. Yeah. And so learning on the auxiliary field turned out to be much more tricky. Yeah. So getting that right. Yeah. So that, you know, the data of the auxiliary field that underlies this. Yeah. To make a discrimination like this didn't work very well. And that's not clear that is actually, you know, why that is. Because, you know, as a physicist, you might say, well, there's the exact same level of information here. Because, you know, from the auxiliary fields, you could, in principle, calculate the Green's function. Yeah. So the neural network could do that. Well, it doesn't, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the amount of information is, in principle, the same. But on the Green's function, it's much easier to do this discrimination. Also, it's a charm that it's a more physical quantity.
How many pictures did you use, say, for the L equals 15?
So what we do is, you know, tens of thousands. We have easy access to those. Yeah? So, you know, so that's very different from, you know, the Cyber Monte Carlo story that we heard earlier in the week. Yeah? So we always have an abundance of data in that sense.
And you, meaning you can just generate it, it's quick to generate it?
So we, you know, so we run our Monte Carlo not in a regime, you know, where we end up having only 5,000 samples. You know, but our biggest system size is basically cut, you know, by the fact, you know, that we are still able to sample tens of thousands of these, you know, configurations. Yeah, so we don't go to that extreme limit, you know, where we reduce ourselves to just a handful.
And how does it depend on that strong? Suppose you continually use smaller numbers.
Yeah. So that's the idea to do this discrimination, you know, we know that you want to do finite size scaling, so you want to, you know, be able to, you know, treat different system sizes approximately the same way. So we don't want to, you know, thin out, you know, to the bigger system sizes. So it's so it's something that we really systematically explored. Good. Okay. So let's go from that supervised approach to an unsupervised approach. Yeah. By making the following observation. Yeah. So when we started this process, you know, we did this training step. And I said, you know, the end of the training step is, you know, that we are able to discriminate very well, you know, at these two, you know, far away parameter points that we are in two different phases. And we see that by the fact that, you know, here, you know, we get a solid zero and here we get a solid one. Yeah. So everything is classified as being, you know, the low U phase, so this, you know, semi-metal, and, you know, the large U phase, you know, that's twin density wave, for these two parameters, and we were able to do that. Yeah? Uh-huh. So we should actually use that as a feature. Now, we were able to discriminate these phases, and we could tell that we were able to do that. Yeah? So now, let's do the following. Let's come up with a scheme that works like this. Yeah? So we try to train the neural network on data where we pretend, you know, that the data is from two different phases. Yeah? So we take a little window here, and now we are going to this infinitesimal range here. So we take some parameter u and the parameter u plus delta u, and we say, you know, I generate for the one parameter, you know, tens of thousands of these images, and I also do that for the other one, and I label the one, you know, as, you know, being phase A, and I label the other one as being phase B without knowing whether they are two different phases, and then I train the neural network, or I try to train the neural network on this, yeah, and I will oftentimes fail. I will fail whenever I actually expose a neural network to the exact same phase, but just, you know, an epsilon, you know, different in parameter space, yeah. And then I slide this window across my parameter range, And eventually, you know, I will find a situation like this one, where indeed, you know, the two parameter points are now chosen across the solution. So now, you know, the distinction between the two, you know, sets of data is much bigger than everywhere else here. Yeah, and we should see, you know, that all of a sudden we are able, you know, to discriminate and see that there is indeed two phases. Yeah. So this is an unsupervised approach. Yeah, because, you know, I try to do supervised learning with fake labels, yeah? But I never know, you know, whether I'd have two different phases or not. Yeah? So I don't put any a priori knowledge into that. Yeah? So let's see how that works. Yeah? So we do this on a simpler model. Yeah? So we do this on a hardcore boson model, mainly because, you know, which we can write in this XXE type of spin model that has a couple of parameters. And, you know, varying these parameters, you know, I have four phases. Yeah? So that's, you know, so that's the phase diagram that has enough, you know, information. It can be, you know, pull that out again by sliding, you know, these windows now across, you know, these parameter spaces and trying to train a neural network on the data, you know, from these two points. Yeah? And this is what you get. Yeah? So, you know, so the Green's function, you know, written in the spins, you know, now looks like, you know, these expectation values. So there's this off-diagonal element here. Yeah? And if you slide this, you know, these guys across, you know, you see that the color coding tells you now how well you could, you know, discriminate the phases, and you clearly map out, you know, the phase boundaries of this phase diagram without any knowledge. Yeah? So that's pretty cool. Yeah. So now we didn't know how many phases there are. We didn't have to put any information about, you know, points, you know, deep in some phases into this. We just, you know, used this infinitesimal, you know, window trick to see exactly what the transition is. Yeah? You go to, you know, the diagonal part of the Green's function, you know, you do so as well, not as beautiful as here. So that's the zero temperature phase diagram. Yeah, you can also go to the finite temperature. That's interesting because, you know, there's different types of orders of phase transitions. Yeah, so there's first, second, and because of the Soundless type phase transition, this finite temperature phase transition phase diagram. And, you know, what we see is, you know, probably not unexpectedly, you know, first order transitions are very easy to see. You know, second order transitions we also see. The cosseted solid transition is hard for us to see. Yeah. So, you know, just, you know, this convolutional trick where we use local information. It's not very good at seeing the KT transition. It's also not totally unexpected. Yeah. It's a vortex, anti-vortex unbinding transition, you know, where we cannot see in these, you know, small matrices. So if you're after cosseted solid transitions, you have to do a little bit more. And Roger and Anna actually have done that in the meantime. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask which unsupervised method you're using here? Did I miss it?
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the idea of the algorithm. Yeah. Okay. So what I'm doing is this. Yeah. So I have this window. Yeah. And I say, you know, here, yeah, there's two different parameters, and I sample for these two different parameters, you know, images of my phases. So that means I generate these Green's functions, and I train, yeah, the neural network with, you know, labeled data from here and here. But these labels are totally fake. Yeah. So I say this is phase A, this is phase B. Yeah. Yeah. And then I ask, you know, in the end, you know, are you able to do this? Yeah. Are you able to discriminate that? Yeah. So I have a measure for this discrimination here. Yeah. That's what's color coded in these images. Yeah. You know, so is it distance here, you know, one, or is it zero? And that's what I call unsupervised, in the sense that I've never used any a priori knowledge about the.
The model you used then was already trained on the classified data, right?
No.
It. Basically turns it into supervised.
Yeah. So I do a supervised step at every one of these, you know, steps here. And I ask, you know, if I do this supervision learning, as I say, you know, this is phase A, this is phase B, where I don't know whether they're two different phases, you know, am I able to train the neural network to discriminate these two things? Yeah. Okay. And in these pictures here, yeah, so wherever you see blue, that's where you failed. Yeah. So you weren't able to discriminate here. Yeah. But here where it's yellow, you were able to discriminate because you effectively chose, you know, a situation like this, yeah, where, you know, your window was, you know, spreading across the phase transition. Yeah. Yeah, so now I'm down to, you know, very small changes, you know, in the images. Yeah, so what I said before, you know, the Ising model question, you know, when you tune the parameter, you know, the images will look different, yeah, you know, a little bit. Yeah. You're not supposed to see that, and you don't see that here. Yeah, but if you go across the phase transition, you know, then you actually do see that. Okay, so that's that this part, you know, an unsupervised approach to map out entire phase diagrams. Yeah, so now we can go a couple of steps further down the road and ask, you know, can we do this with more complex states? Yeah, so one very, you know, short interlude is, you know, can we do this with a topological state, you know, that we can you know, find in a model like this? You know, we are again looking at fermions, but coupled to a Z2 degree of freedom on the bounds of the lattice. Yeah, and so this model, yeah, again has a transition from a Z2 Dirac phase to a spin density wave phase. Yeah, Green's functions, you know, look like these. You know, so much harder to distinguish between the two. But in the end, you know, we go from a gapped phase here, you know, here. The gap is one here, and that, you know, is very easy to see. So we can, you know, again, you know, in this one parameter that we tune the magnetic field in the supervised approach, where we say, you know, there are two different phases. And we can again, you know, do this step of, you know, seeing that they're different, and this unsupervised approach sliding across, you know, the little window spikes exactly also at this transition. You know? So that's actually pretty good in the sense that, you know, for, you know, those people coming before us, where they tried to, you know, find where this transition is, it was much harder for them, you know, to come up with, you know, physical properties, you know, that allows them to do this. You know? But we are in perfectly agreement with that. Okay. So now let's go to the last step, and that is, you know, learning transport. So here's a very quick introduction to that. So quantum phase transitions are generally very well understood in insulators. Yeah. And you know, there's Subir's book on quantum phase transitions. You know, that gives every detail of our understanding about these phase transitions at zero temperature. But you can make things considerably harder if you go to a metal, yeah, and you drive a phase transition in a metal, yeah, and in experiment, you know, this is a situation where you get these phase diagrams of systems which, you know, as a function of some parameters, some doping, for instance, go from a spin density wave in a metal to a conventional metal. So you destroy the spin density wave, and that often comes at the expense of seeing superconductivity show up in these phase diagrams, you know? And this, you know, for many different materials, that's very, you know, these features are very generically there, you know? So can we work with that, and how do we do that? So here's metals 101. A metal is described by a Fermi surface, you know, that this blue line here, that, you know, describes the states, you know, near the Fermi energy. If you have a spin density wave on top of the metal, you know, you have also a momentum in momentum space, you know, the special momentum that describes, you know, that particular magnetic ordering, and that magnetic ordering, you know, will connect, you know, points on the phase on the Fermi surface that are exactly that k vector apart. You know? So those we are calling hotspots. Yeah. So you know, this Fermi surface, for instance, you know, with this momentum vector that orders, has, you know, these 8 hotspots. Yeah. Good. So, you know, simulating a metal, you know, with these hotspots is not easy. Yeah, but we can do the following, and you know, that will allow me to write on a model that I will be able to simulate in the computer. I can make out of one, you know, Fermi surface, two Fermi surfaces, like so. Yeah, so I totally changed the Fermi surface topology from this image to that image, but what I have preserved is the location of the hotspots and the vicinity of the hotspots. Yeah, so the Fermi surface here and the Fermi surface here, and the vicinity of the hotspot, including curvature and everything, is exactly the same. But I have gone from a Fermi surface, which, you know, is a single band, yeah, to a Fermi surface which has two bands here on the right. And actually, you know, this introduction of the second band is very important, because, you know, that is actually what, you know, at the deeper level allows us to simulate a scenario like this one here using fermionic Monte Carlo flavors without a sign problem. Yeah. Because, you know, what it adds is an anti-unitary symmetry, like time reversal symmetry, that kills off the sign problem. Yeah? And now we write down a lattice model in terms of an effective action, which has now two major ingredients. One is the fermions, you know, that form, you know, this Fermi surface. So we, you know, describe these two bands. Yeah? And then in addition, we put something on top, you know, that describes, you know, that spin density wave, the magnetic ordering, you know, with this k vector. So we put, you know, a bosonic phi to the fourth theory on top. Yeah, so we have fermions, we have bosons, and then we couple the two. Yeah, this is a Yukawa coupling. So now we have spins and fermions coupled, and now I have in this phi to the fourth theory one parameter that can vary and drive the system from, you know, the spin density wave metal to a conventional metal. You know, so that's why my parameter that I will vary are. Okay, so that will destroy the magnetic ordering on top of the metal. Yeah, and then you know this is coupled to the fermions, and something will happen. Yeah, and this is what we want to simulate. Yeah? Okay, and we can simulate that, and we can simulate that without a side problem, and generate a phase diagram, yeah, which is quantitatively correct. And here it is. So what you find as you vary that tuning parameter, a very rich phase diagram, yeah, so your spin density wave, yeah, that existed, you know, at that low tuning parameter R goes away, yeah. And there's, you know, some phase transition, you know, somewhere here. Yeah, this is as a function of finite temperature. You have finite temperature, finite temperature transitions because the ozonic theory has a, you know, an order, you know, O2 order parameter, so these are all causalized solid transitions. And the most important point is that we don't see exactly what happened at zero temperature, first of all, because you cannot go to zero temperature, and second of all, because something else happens, and that is, you know, you get a superconducting dome. Yeah? So, and we get a D-wave, you know, superconducting regime here that comes out of that model without, you know, any a priori coupling put into the effective action that talks about pairing channels or any of that. Yeah? So that comes out. Okay, so we know where the system is now superconducting. We know we have the spin density wave, and we know where superconducting fluctuations form. Yeah, you know, in a regime above, you know, that superconducting dome, and that will be relevant for what we do next.
What's the picture that you feed into the model here?
That comes in a second. Okay, yeah. So this is you know, here nothing has happened. So this is just, you know, the prelude. Yeah, we do quantum Monte Carlo on this model and without a sign problem, and we can calculate things like this. And now we want to ask, you know, and you know, these transition lines here have all been determined using rather conventional analyses, you know, looking for these KT transitions. You know?
So why you can't go to zero temperature?
Oh, that's just Monte Carlo. That means, you know, that you have to go to, you know, very long time evolutions, and you know, that will be cut off. It's a scaling question. Yeah? So the inverse temperature is a scaling parameter, and you cannot go to infinity, so you know, to zero temperature. It's a finite temperature.
If you use Monte Carlo, you use something like projective on that is already at zero temperature.
Mm-hmm. So that's fair. Yeah. So you could, yeah, of course, you could try to, you know, with zero temperature calculation, a pure zero temperature calculation, but then, you know, the most interesting features of the space diagram are finite temperature. So the fact, you know, that we have a finite temperature transition into the superconducting dome, so you want to be able to capture that as well, you know? And then having both of, you know.
So here, it like sounds like the limitation is Monte Carlo, right? Because like the abundance of data you have and stuff. Do you know if people have tried like the same technique but with experimental data?
Wait. So again, here nothing has happened machine learning wise.
Yeah. No, I know, but like. Still, it's the limitation, right? Like you are going only like to L15, something like very small systems.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if there's like confusion scheme, like the sensor provided one has been applied
to experimental data? No, that I know. Yeah. Okay. So this is a, you know, the data manufacturing Monte Carlo in the background that we will now want to use for the Monte Carlo. Yeah? So let me say, you know, the standard analysis now also allows us to, you know, find out that this is a D wave, so the pairing channel, by looking at the appropriate, you know, susceptibilities and their finite size scale. Okay, so that's the conventional stuff.
So mm-hmm. I'm sure I read that. I mean, the fact that this is a conventional physical tool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not somehow affecting the calculation. So how can we validate that the calculation are equivalent to the one where you have not separated the
frames? So I cannot. Yeah. So that's the one. Approximation that is done in the entire calculation. Yeah, that is, you know, I mingled with the Fermi surface in the very first step. Yeah, so if you are a person that is interested in cuprates, yeah, and you know you have in mind a single Fermi surface, you might criticize it. Yeah, so you might say, you know, why are you putting, you know, two Fermi surfaces in where there should be only one? But then I said, you know, the crucial feature, you know, that we preserve are the hotspots and their vicinity. And I think there's a general consensus that these are the most relevant features of the Fermi surface, and that I have preserved. Yeah. Now, there's other materials. If you don't look at cuprates, but at nictites, you know, they come out of the box, you know, a two-band Fermi structure, yeah, and they, you know, exhibit phase diagrams that look exactly like the one, you know, that we calculate. Yeah, so that's you know where you can do, you know, quantitative comparisons, which is quite interesting because, you know, after that initial step, there is no approximation whatsoever in calculating that phase diagram. Good. So now we want to ask, you know, can we, you know, recalculate, you know, features of that face diagram, you know, from the data that we generate in that Monte Carlo machinery, now using machine learning approaches. And in principle, we could, you know, again, you know, do exactly what I said before. You know, we can calculate, you know, single particle Green's functions, which you do, yeah, generate tons of data, and then, you know, scan through the data. Yeah. But in doing so, we realized, in talking to Yuna and Frank, you know, that, you know, you can do something much smarter, and that is, you know, instead of doing a convolution as a filter on your data, which is, you know, the step that is motivated from this image recognition community, now we can also try to come up with filters that are more physicsy oriented. Yeah? And, you know, so they describe this under the word quantum loop topography. And now let's ask, you know, what that will do for us. So instead of, you know, calculating arbitrary, you know, Green's function elements, you know, what we are calculating is, you know, these little loops here. And what these little loops are, you know, concatenations of, you know, these pairwise elements of the Green's function into one, you know, string. Yeah. So, and you can do this along a triangle. Yeah, giving you a triangular loop. You can do this along a square, giving you a loop of length 4. Yeah, and generate, you know, these as your input instead of the convolution. Yeah. So it's a different pre-filter, yeah, that you can use. So why is it interesting? Well, you can show that, you know, calculating stuff along these small loops generates for you exactly a calculation of current correlators, and those are good proxies for longitudinal transport. You know? So by looking at these loops, you can hope to establish some transport features of the model. You know? And this is indeed what you can do. Yeah, so here is that phase diagram from before. Yeah, so slightly differently coded. So there's a spin density wave, it's a superconductor, and this gray area is where we find in the conventional analysis, you know, that there is superconducting fluctuations, but not superconductivity. Yeah, and now if you take a cut along this vertical line here, so these red dots here are now these inverse temperatures here, and you know, feed information, you know, from that loop topography, or alternatively, you know, so from the loop topography, or, you know, what we have done before, you know, this convolutional neural network into a artificial neural network, and you know, do this training step, you know, what you find is, you know, curves like these. Yeah? So again, curves that go from 0 to 1, but in a very systematic way. Yeah? So both approaches, you know, max out, yeah, in the superconducting regime. Yeah? So if you train, you know, here and here, so the high temperature, the low temperature regime, you will see the superconductor. You see the high temperature phase, and you actually also see, you know, this range where, you know, you cross over from 0 to 1 exactly maps out, you know, this regime of superconducting fluctuations. So we are really sensitive to that. Yeah. So we see, you know, these fluctuations occurring in this model and this regime in the output of the neural network. Yeah. And we can solidify, you know, that is indeed true. By, you know, going, you know, one step simpler in model calculations, you can go to the Hubbard model, the negative U Hubbard model, yeah, and do, you know, calculations again without a sign problem, and, you know, see that also there, you know, we are very good in seeing, you know, the superconducting regime, yeah, both, you know, the QLT, this loop topography, and the convolutional neural networks, then map out, you know, an additional regime of fluctuations below that. But if you treat the entire system in mean field, and you, you know, take away, you know, this fluctuating regime, yeah, you know, then you see that, you know, this regime in between, yeah, immediately, you know, vanishes. Yeah, so you immediately map out, you know, just the one transition that there is, yeah, from superconducting to not. Okay, so that makes us very hopeful. Yeah, so now we are able to, you know, probe transport. And what we're now trying to do is to go one step further. So in this phase diagram, you know, what we are hoping to see is also a regime like this, a strange metal regime, yeah, that distinguishes itself, you know, in its transport properties from, you know, more conventional metallic regimes over here, yeah. And so we are trying to see, you know, whether we can see actually indications of that. Yeah. So if you learn here with this here, yeah, that there is a distinction in the transport properties, you know, as mapped out through these. This loop topography framework. Yeah, so we're still working on that. So that's happening. So let me close with, you know, one last example where we use machine learning and bring it into contact with a sign problem. Yeah, so we have looked at many fermion problems so far, but they were all set up in a way that we avoided having, you know, the sign problem in the generation of the original data. Yeah, but it's very easy to create a sign problem. So if we go back to our initial example, where we have you know fermions, you know, on that honeycomb lattice, and you know, we have this, you know, some interaction term that drives you from the Dirac semi-metal to an ordered phase. If you take away the spin degree of freedom from the fermions and we make them spin less fermions, and then you take away time reversal symmetry, the anti-unitary symmetry that actually killed the sine problem in the original problem, and you introduce it. Yeah? So this Hamiltonian has a severe sine problem. You will hear what that is in just a second. You can get rid of it again, yeah, by going from complex fermions to Majorana fermions. Majorana fermions are particle symmetric, another anti-unitary symmetry that will eliminate the sine problem in this particular problem. And you can, you know, in the Majorana fermion basis, solve that problem, meaning you can simulate it in Majorana fermions and, you know, find out where the phase transition is. This is exactly not what we will do. Yeah? So we will stay with complex fermions, and we will expose ourselves to the sine problem and still ask, you know, whether we can do something interesting. Yeah? So the same, you know, procedure as before. We train in the different phases, and we look in between. So what's the sine problem? Yeah. So we heard this, you know, in rough terms, you know, earlier in the week. So here it's more specifically again. So we do Monte Carlo. We are interested in calculating the expectation value of some observable. Okay. So that works by, you know, mapping to some, you know, classical system that you can simulate using Markov chain Monte Carlo, such as world lines or, you know, this Haber-Zatanovich decoupled fermions. You know? So these are configurations that you can generate in a Monte Carlo process, in a Markov chain process. And then, you know, by generating this Markov chain, we are generating these configurations according to some, you know, probability distribution P. Yeah? So that's our normalization here. And we can then, you know, along the way, you know, measure, you know, our expectation, but measure our observable, and then approximate, you know, this expectation. Now, if in the mapping to the classical problem, you manage to, you know, get some configurations whose probability becomes negative, and then you have a situation to deal with. And one situation to deal with is that you say, well, whenever I have a negative probability, I mod it out and I make it a positive probability. Okay, so you mod it everything out. We can, you know, do this strictly here as well. Yeah, we can write in terms of every probability, we can just write, you know, the mod of probability, so the absolute value of the probability times, you know, the sign of that probability. So then we can stare at this term here and say, well, you know, I can just, you know, divide, you know, denominator and numerator by, you know, the sum over the modeled out probabilities, and I end up, you know, with two new expectation values. So numerator will give me the expectation value of the observable times the sign in an ensemble that is sampling, you know, the modded probabilities over, you know, the expectation value from the bottom, and that's just the sign. Okay, so I have these two expectation values. The sign problem now is, yeah, so up to here I haven't done anything wrong. Yeah? So everything's correct. Yeah, so this expectation value here and that expectation value over here are identically the same. Yeah? The problem is that both the numerator and the denominator go to zero exponentially fast. Yeah. Yeah, so if I have a sign problem, meaning, you know, that means that, you know, the sign, you know, fluctuates, you know, between the configuration. I have positive and negative signs, so their expectation value of the sign goes to zero. Yeah, and so does the numerator. And then as I try to divide zero by zero, you know, trying to do this in the correct way, you know, is exponentially hard for me. Okay, and that is a real sign problem. It's a problem that I try to correct. Yeah, and this statistical analysis, this last step, and, you know, get the correct value here for the left. Yeah, so let's try not to do that. Yeah, let's try to not, you know, correct in the statistical sense, you know, what we are trying to do, but ask a different question. You know, if you are sampling in the modded ensemble, so there should be a line here. Yeah, can we identify a state function? Yeah, that goes from 0 to 1 between, you know, the two phases, you know, that are the phases of interest in our model. Yeah, and can we calculate that from the data that we have? Yeah, so, and how we do that? Well, we do this again by you know, calling this machine learning machinery to help. Yeah? So let's do that. And here's the result of that. Yeah? So here's our problem with sign problem. Yeah? So as I vary my parameter, I have now a strong sign problem. So the sign that I will see is strictly zero. So the expectation value is always zero. And it's actually a complex sign, so I'm everywhere in the complex plane. Okay. Good. So it looks like everything is lost. So so I should be dividing zero by zero to calculate some expectation values. But if I just take that modern ensemble, and I follow the same procedure as before, I say, well, there's one phase and another phase. Let me train on that, and generate data in between. What do you think? Do you have the one phase or the other phase? And interestingly enough, what we see is a very smooth curve again, going from 0 to 1. And that is a remarkable feature in itself. It's very smooth. So it doesn't fluctuate like all over the place. Which the observable with the sign problem actually would do. Because you do this 0 by 0 division, you get a big error bar, and everything can fluctuate like crazy. Nothing fluctuates like crazy, but it's very smooth, and it even shows nicely a sharpening up as you go to bigger system sizes. And the data trends towards this vertical line, which is the phase transition line calculated from the Majorana fermion calculation, which you're not doing, which gives us the correct solution. That's quite interesting, And it's interesting also because, you could have done the entire same calculation with bosons instead of fermions, And that would have given you a phase transition over here, So in a totally different place, So it's certainly not what we're doing. So despite the fact that we are working in that modded ensemble, we are not simulating bosons, So we are still simulating fermions, and we recover, this phase transition in a remarkable way. So you can ask, what's the level of ignorance that you have applied? By taking this modded ensemble, what you're really getting insensitive to is, your fermions can still wind around one another and pick up minus ones, but you don't know whether they have done so in even or an odd time. So that's what you basically ignore. So we find that actually works amazingly well. So that's sort of interesting. It's not very systematic in the sense that we can say, for what kind of problems will this work? But many fermion problems with the sign problem are so hard, and we don't know any method, that quantitatively works. But this is actually, an interesting perspective, to go in there and try to find out, what the topology of some phase diagram, might look like, using exactly, these approaches that we have been discussing here. Okay. Good. So with that, I'm already over my time. Let me conclude. So what I've shown you is that this approach of using pattern recognition algorithms, so convolutional neural networks, or slightly more physicsy oriented loop topography networks, work very well together with Monte Carlo data. You can use supervised and unsupervised approaches to learn phase diagrams. You can discriminate phases from one another. And you have a new opportunity, as I would like to phrase it, to circumvent the sign problem. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
After a couple of questions.
Sorry, I sort of missed the punchline of circumventing the sign problem. Mm-hmm. What did the neural net or machine learning do for you when you weren't able to evaluate the ratio?
So what I was able to do is, pull off this curve. So despite, working with, with a severe sign problem, so the sign fluctuating like crazy, I can pull out using that machine learning approach, a curve that's very smooth, and that seems to converge very well to the known exact result. So from other numerical calculations, that do not have a sign problem. So you, despite,
What is the input to the machine learning? What is the picture?
Oh, so these pictures are again these Green's functions. So it's exact same as before. Like in the spinful case where you didn't have a sign problem, and now go to the sign problem case. I modify the ensemble in which I sample, and generate these images, and train on those images. And then I ask from that where do you think the transition is, and the point is that you are very close to where the real transition is.
You can generate those Green's function images efficiently even though there's a sign problem.
Well, we can do so in the modified ensemble. Yeah. So if you mod out the probability, we can generate, you know, these
images. So that's what you just ignore the sign, take absolute values.
Exactly. That's what I expect.
Yeah. So you don't get the actual Green's function, but some kind of
so I get the Green's function in a slightly modified ensemble.
Okay.
Yeah? And then the question is, you know, can you recover what you have done incorrectly here? So typically what we do is, you know, the statistical analysis of, you know, calculating this, you know, operator time sigma over sigma, yeah, which we correct for that. Yeah. And here we just don't do that step, but instead, you know, do the machine learning. Yeah.
So in this case, how do you compute observers?
Mm-hmm. So like
say I want to compute an observer.
Yeah, so of course you can calculate an observer. Yeah. You can still do that. And then, you know, you should be doing, you know, exactly this. Okay, but then you have a problem, exactly. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's what you try to avoid. Yeah. So instead of asking, you know, the question of can I calculate, you know, some observable of interest, you know, which might help me to, you know, discriminate whether I have phase A or phase B, I'm doing something different. And what I do differently is, you know, that all I'm asking now is, can I discriminate the two phases and you know, find where the transition between the two is? Yeah, by doing this.
Yeah, but if I'm not interested in having the phase, I just want to know the energy of my system.
Mm-hmm. No, So that's a question of, you know, what you're interested in. Yeah. So you know, in this entire talk, you know, we have been interested in trying to map out phase diagrams, you know, one way or the other. Yeah. And this is a way to do that. Yes. And you know, as we, you know, might map out, you know, these diagrams, you know, we are not totally you know, unknown about, you know, these systems. So sometimes, you know, there are some limits, you know, in which we can actually say, well, you know, here it must be that or there it must be that. So what I really see is, you know, the transition lines. Yeah. So I, you know, like coming from these extreme limits. Yeah. But I'm not, you know, but this does not help me in calculating, you know, your arbitrary expectation value.
Yeah, but typically when you talk about a sign problem, it pops out when you want to compute observables.
Yes. Yes, but you calculate observables in order, yeah, to find out whether you're in this phase or that phase. You know, do you have a superconductor or not? You know, that's why you have to go through the observable. So here is a way of not going through the observable, but still finding out whether you're in this phase or that phase.
Can I have a related question? So in a sense, this phase transition is a phase transition in the modified problem.
Yes.
And is that a problem that we can solve analytically and show that that the phase transition there is at the same place as in the original?
No. Yeah. So that's exactly what I said. So we do have a systematic problem. Yeah. And then we modify the ensemble. Okay. So we go to these modded values. Yeah. Which again, it's clearly different from, you know, being totally ignorant and making fermions to bosons. Yeah, what we become, you know, ignorant about is, you know, the number of windings that the fermions do around one another. You know, but that's an even or an odd number. That's exactly, you know, what the sign encodes in this problem. So that's what we no longer know. But we still allow the fermions to wind around another and pick up minus signs. Yeah. So it's modified fermions.
Okay. But is there any chance we would have an exact solution for these modified fermions?
So that's, you know, so in general, it's very hard to say, yeah? So, you know, for you know, some...
No, but for this particular one, I mean, in general, for fermions, you don't have the full line either, right? You don't
exactly
have the word if transition
is in general. So for the generic, you know, fermion problem, you know, with a sign problem, you have nothing.
Yes.
Yeah? So you're happy about anything. Yeah? And that's what I'm saying, trying to say, you know? So this is what we do, yeah? We give you at least some hint, yeah? Okay? And we show you by example where it works. Yeah. Okay. As I said, you know, this is not a systematic solution to anything. Yeah. So that's, you know, what I said. You know, it's an opportunity to circumvent the problem. Yeah. It's not solving the problem. Yeah. But it's helping you to get, you know, some inputs. So that's the idea of doing this.
So, I have a question. In the ensemble,
do
I need scale? What I need fake levels to this small supervisor. Mm-hmm. So suppose that I had no idea about the physics,
mm-hmm,
and then I have a phase diagram with lines going here and there. How can I know that this is superconductivity, this is charges?
Yeah. So that's exactly what we did in that, is, you know, example that I showed you where we had these yellow lines. Yeah. So, you know, I show you that, whoop, you know, there's four different phases, but what I haven't learned is what the phases are. Yeah,
exactly.
But you see, you know, how these phases connect, you know, to extreme limits. Yeah, and often those extreme limits you can understand, yeah, by different approaches, you know, because, you know, in that you know, some parameter is very large, and you can understand your fermion model or whatever model you have, you know, again, yeah. So you know that in that limit you must have, I don't know, a Mott insulator. So you know that, aha, you know, so apparently everything here must be the Mott insulator because, you know, there's a transition line on here. Yeah, and then that's how you can, you know, start to assemble, you know, the actual content of these phases into these phase diagrams.
And then there was a phase in the middle that you said you were looking for.
So that's a different problem. So that's very much connected to the idea of you know, probing transport properties. Yeah. So you know, there's strong, you know, experimental indications, you know, that such a phase exists. Yeah. Okay. And the question is, you know, whether our model, you know, includes, you know, such an additional regime. Okay, which is not, you know, discriminating it's, you know, from the rest here through a phase transition, but through different transport properties. Now, calculating these transport properties in a conventional Monte Carlo calculation would, you know, require you to do an analytical continuation, which is an ill-defined problem. Okay, so you cannot do that, you know, in a kosher way. Yeah, so that's why it's, you know, why this is, you know, in the background image, you know, that shows you all the exact results that we can pull out of the QMC is not included. Yeah. But now that we have seen that, you know, doing this loop topography, yeah, we can actually probe transport. Yeah? So we can, for instance, you know, see this, you know, fluctuation regime. Yeah? The question is, you know, can we push it further, yeah, to discriminate, you know, transport properties here from there, and thereby start to map something, you know, like so. And if we do so, and we see, you know, this cone-like structure, you know, then we, you know, claim victory. Yeah? That our data actually allows us to see something more than we can, you know, access, you know, through conventional analysis. Yeah? So that's the idea.
So, since I came here late, so when you do the neural network, so the data set is the configuration, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when it is very close to the phase transition, the critical point, actually the same configuration can both appear at different mm-hmm. phases. But only with different probabilities. So, but when you clean this data or this configuration, mm-hmm. there will be an output. So which
yes.
Which phase will it?
Yeah. So that's exactly, you know, you have seen that these curves are not, you know, going from 0 to 1, but they actually smoothly go from 0 to 1. Yeah. So there is exactly this phase, you know, where 20% of, you know, the samples are, you know, labeled this way or the other way, yeah, giving you this finite value. So that's exactly this regime where that happens, what you described.
Yeah? My question was, suppose you want to go into a superconducting fluctuation regime to test your machine. What if you measure the pair field susceptibility in there at those temperatures, which you can do, I think?
So again, this is, you know, given the problem that I know a lot about, yeah, I can of course go in and try to calculate my conventional Monte Carlo that I have no access to, you know, all these kind of observables. And that's, you know, what we independently do, okay? Yeah.
That's what I was wondering. How does it compare with the area of
you? So I cannot answer that. Yeah. So we haven't done. But that's something we could do, yeah. And but that's just conventional analysis of Monte Carlo.
Okay, let's thank Sion again.
I still don't know. It's a conclusion.